Welcome to The Book Show. This week we look at the work of Irish writer John McGahern, approaching the 10th anniversary of his death. He's best remembered for his controversial and insightful portraits of Irish life in the 1950s and 1960s, in novels such as The Barracks, Amongst Women, and That They May Face the Rising Sun. This evening we'll explore a number of his works, visit the NUI Galway archives, and speak to readers in Leitrim about his writing. Early on in his writing career, his second novel, The Dark, was banned. Let's have a listen to John McGahern himself speaking on Rattlebag with Miles Dungan in 2002 and his reaction to this censorship.
I was a bit ashamed, and in that sense I was belonged to the first generation to be born into this country. It was our country now, as we wanted to make it as good as we could. We couldn't blame anybody else, and I thought that just with our censorship board and all those kind of, we were making bloody fools out of ourselves, and I was kind of ashamed.
Why did you not then, as others have done, reject the Ireland which had rejected you?
I don't think that you can reject anything myself. Is you have only one life. This is my country. That was the weather of my life. And you make the best you can out of it.
And that was John McGahern speaking on Rattlebag with Miles Dungan in 2002. Now, joining me from the University of Liverpool is Dr. Frank Shovlin, who's currently writing two books on John McGahern. And we're also joined from Enniskillen by writer Carlo Gebler, who has adapted a number of McGahern's works for television. Frank, his first novel, The Barracks, details the life of a rural garda and his wife who's dying of cancer. And it was very clear to people from the get-go that this was a writer who had a new approach. But what was different about this book and his early work and how it profiled Irish life?
Well, I think it was unstinting in its criticism of certain aspects of Irish life, of the narrowness, the control of the church. But I think all of those things really are not as important as the story, which is a story that's been told many times of what does a sensitive person like Elizabeth Regan do in the face of death. That's the importance. In a way, I think that John McGahern, his work has often been misunderstood because we go looking for socio-historical lessons, we go looking for ways to read Ireland of the 1950s and 60s, when in fact I think we ought to be paying more attention to the writing, the great works of literature that he's producing. So, you know, the importance of The Barracks is simply that it's great literature, as are all of his novels, as are all of his short stories. He's a great writer. Sure, we can learn things about Ireland of the mid-20th century by reading The Barracks and how life was lived then, but that's not the most important thing, I think.
Carlo, there's no doubt that he was a great writer. And how do you feel about that perspective on life at the time? When you were reading McGahern's work back then, did you feel it was breaking new ground?
When I was reading McGahern first, what compelled me were, first of all, the specificity. He doesn't write he doesn't use generalities. He doesn't have kind of long sections describing what people would do. He has long sections describing what people do on a particular day at a particular time. And that kind of specificity extends to everything, to objects and clothes and the way people talk and so on. And you really feel that you're in the company of someone who knows what they're talking about. And the other thing about him is his technique is often quite cinematic. I mean, he will have a conversation and then cut in the middle of the chapter, in the middle of the page, to something connected to that happens later. And you get these really exciting moments where things are abutted against each other. But reading him now as a bitter 61-year-old, you know, the person I think about is Orwell. I think that his subject, McGahern's subject, was the way in which people's ability to love was destroyed. But it isn't an ideology implemented by a political party, as it is in Orwell. It's the practice of faith imposed by the Catholic Church. And that is right across everything that he writes. And that gives it incredible power. And then on top of that, I mean, because that means there's always conflict between the little person, so to speak, and the system. And then on top of that, he has all these personal conflicts, things that people are personally worried about, their health and so on, education, their future. And this terrible sort of agglomeration of conflicts are melded together. And it produces prose, because conflict is what drives us to read, that is unputdownable.
Well, we'll come back to his books later, but a lot of people don't know that McGahern's work is in the archive in NUI Galway. So we went along to meet the archivist Barry Hoolan, who began by describing the extent of the collection.
It's a huge archive for a writer. It's over 40 boxes of manuscripts. And to condense one writer's work into such a collection, it's amazing to see it as a volume of manuscripts, of letters, of correspondence, of typescripts. So it's a wonderful record of the writer at work, really. All evidence of the writer is there from his beginnings, his drafts, his research, right through to the final published works.
So we're looking at a manuscript of The End or the Beginning of Love, which is an unpublished and very early work of McGahern's. It actually has its address not as Leitrim, but as Clontarf in Dublin. What is actually contained here? What are we looking at?
What we're looking at here are two early typescripts for John's first novel. It was accepted for publication by Faber, but it was John himself who withdrew it from publication. He was unhappy with it. He thought it wasn't ready to go, out into the world at that time. And I think that's even an early sign of John's perfectionism as a writer, that any young writer would want his first novel to go out for publication. But no, he withheld it back. So I even think that this piece of the archive is very revealing about John's mindset as a young writer. These two typescripts are, again, two drafts. They're different from each other, and that's typical of John's writing as well. No two items will ever be similar. There will be alterations, corrections, changes of characters, of names, of place, of time throughout. And I think that's John's skill. He can condense two pages of draft into one page of solid writing ready for publication thereafter. So I think that's something that he can see right across all his drafts. So right in front of me is a letter of confirmation from the New Yorker magazine, who published John McGahern's stories. And this is a letter from the editor of the New Yorker to his sub-editor. And he's telling the sub-editor to contact John McGahern, that he's been successful in having his story to be published in the New Yorker. And the editor writes and he says, "But you must now revise your belief that you don't know how to tell a good manuscript from a bad one. You have changed, you have learned, and if you see any more of this calibre floating around Dublin, start them on their way to me."
That's W.M. William Maxwell, obviously.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So again, you can see the recognition that McGahern is getting in one of the biggest publications in the world at this time. So this would start John on his way to being an internationally recognised writer.
Speaking of the New Yorker again, just to my left, I've spotted Strand Till the Sea. And I think, was that the first story that he ever had published in the New Yorker?
Yes, that's it. So that was the subject of the letter from Maxwell. And again, it's a story that would be typical of McGahern's style that would come in the short form as well as in the long form. And it brings everything back to, I think, personal experience from McGahern. He can translate his own and project his own experience onto the characters and then also onto the reader. He may not consider himself an autobiographical writer. I think what his readers get from these stories, from Strand Hill to Sea, from Sierra Leone, from The Wine Breath, any of them, he could pick and choose, is they can see so much of their own experience in John's writing.
What's really striking as well is that we have a typewritten copy with the paperclip on it, but also we have a version of it written in what looks like a kid's school copybook, and it's written in red ink with those familiar sort of scratchings out. But there's a lot of copybooks and sort of kids' school books, so it seems like he used whatever was to hand to sort of get the words down on the page.
Mm-hmm. I suppose he was a teacher, so he had access, easy access. He would write in this flowing, kind of sharp, angular manuscript hand. Again, he would write and write and redraft and redraft. That's the bulk of the archive, are these amazing revealing drafts. And I think for any reader of McGahern, it's the archive can give them that impossible access to the mind of McGahern as he's writing. Again, the manuscript in the copybooks or on any A4 scrap of paper, I think they reveal the process of the writer at work, and they stay in manuscript until there is a good bulk of a story together. McGahern did not type anything up until he had, if not a finished version, a near finished version. That's not to say it would be the last version, because even then he would return to his typescripts and again add his own annotation to them.
And that was Barry Hoolahan there from NUI Galway. We'll explore more of that archive in just a few moments, but still with me are Frank Shovlin and Carlo Gebler. Carlo, you actually adapted some of McGahern's short stories for TV and also The Leave-Taking. When you were working on those adaptations, what stood out for you in his writing style?
Well, they're pitiless, as I think has already been alluded to. I did the first part of The Leave-Taking, and I did The Key and I did Swallows, two short stories. And The Leave-Taking, I just did the first part. It's about a teacher on his last day. He's about to be sacked, and he's thinking about various things. And he's sort of mustering the boys in the playground after break to go in. And there's a line: "As I take the bell by the tongue, shock of the erection I got when first I beat a boy with a cane. And you read a sentence like that and you think, it is truly shocking. It's still shocking now. And it's also a sentence that gets at the way the oppressed internalise the values of the oppressor. They do the oppressor's work. The man hates his job, hates what he's doing, and yet he is also, he realises, in effect, an instrument of oppression. That kind of, when you encounter that in writing, you never forget it. So that's what struck me, his truthfulness.
But were they easy to adapt for the screen? I mean, were the visuals already there?
No, they weren't. Because you had to find ways to externalise the incredibly detailed sort of topographical picture of the psyche that he presents. However, there is one thing to be said. He will also, his prose is salted with these incredible images that get at people's personal anguish. So in Swallows, a sort of frustrated guard looks into a surveyor's car and sees a evening dress and a violin, and suddenly through what he sees, you have access to his thwartedness, his not fulfilling himself as a musician or an artist. So there are those sorts of things in McGahan that you can latch onto, but you also have to find other kinds of visual material to amplify the inner life of the characters.
Well, another huge influence on his work was, of course, his own family. Let's go back to the archives in NUI Galway, where archivist Barry Houlihan shows me a letter from McGahan Sr. to his son John.
And this is a letter from Frank Sr. to his son John, or Sean as he calls him. And again, it's written in January 1960. And again, as Frank Sr. is such a polemic presence in the life of John, so much of it comes back to family lives and family beliefs. And of course, his Catholicism and religion plays a big part of that. So this is a letter from father to son. There is obviously some tension and friction brewing between them. And it all comes back down to John's, not so much departing, but shying away from his Catholic beliefs of his father.
Is there a particularly telling section that you could read for us?
Sure. Okay. My dear Sean, your letter was unworthy of you, hence my failure to reply, so I might impress that on you. Your religion, or lack of it, is to be deplored, and my vows won't cause you unhappiness, either in this life or the log state. I must insist on your filial cooperation so that you won't make other members of the family as unhappy as yourself. I must for myself claim the same privileges. In all other respects, you can accept me or leave me alone as a loving father. And he signs off the letter, your daddy.
That gives you a real sense of how he kind of tried to work out the problem and grapple with his father in the fiction. He absolutely did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Frank, perhaps not named, but he's obviously a huge character in so many of the novels and in the stories as well. That relationship that Frank had with John's mother, Susan, is also played out in so many different places. It's obviously there in the barracks. It's there in amongst women. And even as John would say himself, his own vocation was to follow in his mother's footsteps as a teacher. So again, you can see perhaps an allegiance to one over the other. But it's a huge, huge influence on John and crafted so many elements of his writing.
Well, we heard in that letter the influence that the father was trying to exert on his son. Frank, how does this show in his writing? How does he deal with his father in his work?
Well, father figures are there as major characters in the barracks, the dark, to a lesser degree, the leave-taking. I suppose maybe perhaps most famously, Moran in Amongst Women. And right throughout his short stories, you know, you get a very chilling short story like Korea, where a boy realizes that his father is willing to see him go away and die in the Korean War because he'll make a few pound out of it. So it's very, at times, it's a very scarifying picture of a father. But there's also great love there. I mean, and Korea is the best example of it, where the boy realizes that this is what his father is willing to see happen to him. But he says, at that moment, he's never felt closer to his father. And he thinks of his father carrying him on his shoulders above a crowd at a football match. So there are moments of tenderness, but there are moments of terrible violence. I think Neil Corcoran, in his book on Irish literature after Yeats and Joyce, describes that opening scene in the dark where the boy is asked to strip and his father is getting ready to thrash him as the most terrifying moment in Irish literature. And it's hard to disagree with that.
one of the books I think about when it comes to families amongst women. It's a novel that was published in 1990 and shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It tells the story of an old IRA veteran, Michael Moran, and his relationship with both his family and modern Ireland. Writer Eilis Ní Gubhna reflects on the impact of this novel.
I think the key to the great success of Amongst Women is actually in the title, and it's in the word women. The new departure for McGahern is that he's now focusing on the women in the family. Moran is the typical Irish patriarch, still sort of at the centre of things, but he's very much dependent on his daughters and his wife, and they have moved out of the margins of literature, of fiction, centre stage in this novel.
Sometimes in the evenings, she had too strong a sense of being locked into the life of the farmhouse. Even with the door continuously open on the summer yard, her brother away in the fields, her mother stumbling about the place with buckets, leaning on the table or the back of a chair whenever she stood to talk.
The book comes out in 1990. The 1980s is the decade of the woman's voice in Irish literature. It seemed to be almost suddenly discovered that there was the huge gender gap in Irish literature. It's the decade of the feminization of Irish literature. And I think McGahern is aware of this and focuses on women more so than in any of his previous novels. It fitted into the zeitgeist.
He told Maggie out of the blue that he wanted to see her alone. He felt garbed in the robes of responsibility and consequence as he spoke. "What would you think if I were to bring someone new into the family? If I was to fill your mother's place, the Lord have mercy on her soul, with someone new, if I were to marry again?" Whether it was the sudden mention of her mother or the whole emotional portentousness with which he had charged the scene, Maggie burst out sobbing. This continued for a long time, during which he shuffled his feet uncomfortably, controlling his immediate impulse to shout at her to be quiet.
There's a huge difference between the way the sons and the daughters behave towards Moran. Women are very forgiving. It seems they'll put up with any kind of nonsense from this basically pretty awful man, Moran. Oh, he's charismatic, he's handsome, but he's so bad-tempered. But the girls seem to be under his spell, which is kind of sexual spell. And the boys just get out and have big fights with Moran and so on. The men are still being portrayed as the combative, strong, independent characters. And for all the message of the novel that the women are very important, the girls are still dancing around and dependent on this heroic, charismatic and bad character. If an episode stays with me, it's a rather simple and rather comic episode, really, which is the courtship of Rose and Moran taking place in the unlikely setting of a post office.
"Were you expecting an important letter?" "No," he laughed. "What makes you think that?" "Oh, I just wondered. I come nearly every evening for the post. It gets you out of the place. It saves wondering the next day whether Jimmy Lynch will bring anything to the house or not."
The kind of dance of the courtship between Rose and Moran is portrayed absolutely convincingly. She moves forward, he moves back, she moves forward. It's a courtship dance. It's psychologically very convincing. On the other hand, it's actually very amusing. It's comic. It's a laugh.
And that was Eilis Ní Gubhna speaking there with recordings of John McGahern reading Amongst Women for the Book on One from the RTÉ archives. If Amongst Women reflected the changing landscape of Irish family life, his work often reflected the landscape of his home county, Leitrim. We went to a readers' group in Ballinamore to hear local reactions to his work 10 years on.
He described, I suppose, nature, as it were, how things, you can see, you know, the hawthorn bushes as you go along, you know, the flowers and the weeds and that kind of thing.
"Lots of hills and twisty, turny roads, small little roads." And
I suppose maybe when you're from the area, you don't see it in the same light. It's then when you read or maybe go back on it, you think, oh yeah, it's very descriptive.
Scattered houses. I suppose in McGahern's books, there were it was more densely populated, not densely, but more people around, like you could hear, you know, in some of the stories, he's going visiting and calling on those people and other people along the lake and around.
then Coote Hall, where he lived at the barracks down there as well, on the way to Boyle. That's familiar, you know, as well.
Connections every place, and people related to one another, and carrying stories and telling the news of the day. And
I didn't enjoy the novels. I found them rather disturbing. It isn't a world that I would recognise. You know, I grew up in a city. No, I'm more interested in what he says about his actual life, you know. And then once I'd read that, I could feed it back perhaps a bit more into the novels and understand more, you know, where he was coming from.
Some of his earlier novels were very dark, and yeah, and some people just didn't like that at all, even though amongst women, yeah, well, that to me, you know, rung quite true because of my own generation of what, because the men were the dominant people in the houses, and it was, you know, quite realistic, I thought.
Everything was so censored that time that people just didn't talk about those things. In general, at that time, people liked to keep those things hidden and not to talk about them. And maybe that's why he wrote, to bring them out, but then he wasn't allowed the freedom of it being on sale, his book.
Yes, I would agree with you. I think he was before his time. I think Irish country people, you know, being one of them myself, do not like their dirty linen held, you know, held out in public. So if there's anything going on, it's much better swept under the carpet than anybody hearing about it. What the neighbours think is always very important in the country. So I can see that McGahan would have upset people with his bearing all.
Well, they're so cruel, you know, and so in some ways kind of hopeless, claustrophobic, small-minded, you know, mean, spiteful. And the fact that he could write in a way that's respected by other writers, you know, he's not just portraying gossip or scandal, he's not just doing it for the sake of shocking people, he's doing it because this was his experience, and he was able to put it across in a very powerful way. I mean, I was disturbed by it because he'd done it so well. Not, you know, I'm not criticising him for doing it. But I, you know, I can only take so much.
And thanks there to Ballinamore Readers Group. Frank, people might be surprised by some of the reactions we heard there. There's a, you know, there's an uneasiness. Is there a sense that somehow we're in danger of turning McGahan into a cosy heritage figure, which I guess would undermine his writing, wouldn't it?
It would. I see McGahan as a major figure in world literature. We all have to come from somewhere. I'm sure, again, a writer like James Joyce, some of the things he was writing would have made his friends and family uncomfortable. Ultimately, McGahan's themes are universal, as they are for all great writers. So they're about what do we do in the world? What should we do with our lives? You think of the boy at the end of the dark who's come up to Galway to start university and can't face it, and decides, well, what is there to do? You know, do I stay here and try to achieve myself at university, or do I go out and achieve something in the world? Each of the novels, each of the short stories, the central figures are faced with these sorts of dilemmas. When a writer is a truly great writer, those ideas get us in the gut, and I can't think of any writer who does that better than McGahan. It's a very emotional experience reading McGahan, a kind of a draining experience at times. Sometimes you have to put the book down. The barracks, you know, it's a frightening story of terminal illness and what one does with the knowledge that death is approaching. But great writing catches that. It never becomes maudlin. It never becomes melodramatic. It's always what Joyce would describe as scrupulously mean. And that was a favourite phrase also of John McGahan's, that we ought to write with scrupulous meanness, without exaggeration, without melodrama. And McGahan does that better, I think, than any other Irish prose writer since Joyce.
Well, we certainly don't want people putting McGahan's work down. We want them to pick them up and read him. So, Carlo, where would you suggest people start with his writing?
I would start with the book that's already been alluded to that has the most terrifying opening in Irish literature. I would start with The Dark. It's compressed. It's a searing. It's about something. I mean, all of his work is about something. It is about how to live, how to make your way in the world.
And how to escape oppression.
The oppression of the family and the oppression of the system of society. And it's done, yes, so lucidly, so limpidly, so scrupulously, so simply, it's unforgettable. So that would be my counsel. If that's too hardcore, then go to the barracks and then just move on. I would actually counsel people to read the work chronologically.
I'd agree. I'd go with The Dark, The Barracks, and probably Amongst Women. So huge thanks to Carlo Gebler and Frank Shovlin. Frank Shovlin's forthcoming books about McGahern, there are two, Touchstones, John McGahern's Classical Style, will be published by Liverpool University Press. And he's also working on a collection of John McGahern's letters for Faber. If you'd like to read Carlo Gebler's own work, his most recent book, The Projectionist, is published by New Island Books. Thanks also to Éilis Ní Gúibhne, to Barry Houlihan and the archives in NUI Galway, as well as the Ballinamore Readers Group. You can listen back to the book show on SoundCloud and RTE.ie. And finally, thanks to the production team, producer Regan Hutchins and series producer Zoe Cummins.